Welcome to News Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and we're privileged to have with us at WCHL again our favorite presidential historian and nationally, internationally renowned historian. William Luchtenberg is the William Rand Keenan Professor Emeritus at Carolina and has proved it again. He's the leading historian of the American presidency with your latest book. It's not new anymore, but it's still being talked about, and people are telling me, Bill Luchtenberg, that they're almost through with it, that they're working on it, that they're working on it, chapter by chapter.
Yeah, it's a long book, and different people have been teasing me about the length of the book. Well, it was published last December, so it's reasonably new. It isn't a year old yet.
I think it was carefully done so that it could be Christmas presents for two Christmases.
And if
you have a person who has gotten interested in politics because of the current election, read backwards and see that maybe, I'm hoping you're going to tell us, that our presidential election this year has some parallels in the past, or does it?
I was on a panel this year, and I said the reason you put a historian on a panel is that he will say, you think this is bad, why back in, fill in the blank, things were even worse, but not this year.
Oh, you can't see, there's no.
I don't know of any historian who would say there's been a campaign of this sort before.
What sets this campaign apart so that it cannot be compared to prior campaigns? Because you've always been able to reach back and find, well, this is not new. This happened before.
Well, there have been times in the past when the electorate was unhappy with the choice confronting it. And we now remember John F. Kennedy fondly, but in 1960, when Kennedy was running for the first time against Nixon, bumper stickers read, "Vote no on president."
Yeah.
But there has never been a contest before where such a large percentage of the electorate was so dissatisfied with both candidates, did not trust either candidate. In fact, a poll I saw on CNN this morning indicated that only 4% of the American people do not think that the election of one of the two major party candidates would be disastrous for the country. That is a very unusual circumstance.
The history of the country with respect to third party candidates is interesting, but usually doesn't have an impact on the presidential results. In your book, you point out that there were some occasions where third party participation disrupted and changed the outcome.
Yes, certainly this happened in 1912 with Theodore Roosevelt running on a progressive ticket. The consequence was that the Democratic candidate, Woodrow Wilson, received only 42% of the popular vote, but in a divided field, divided among three party candidates of a traditional sort, and also a socialist candidate, Eugene Debs, who got nearly a million votes, that Wilson, with just 42% of the popular vote, was elected president of the United States. What's interesting this year, D.G., is that there are two minor party candidates who've been getting significant, though not huge, support in the polls, and have not been fading away. What's happened in most past years is that a candidate is expected to get have an enormous impact on the results. For example, in 1948, Henry Wallace, it was thought, on a Progressive Party ticket, would take a large chunks, certainly the state of California, away from the Democratic candidate, Harry Truman, and that didn't happen. Third-party candidate support evaporates the closer you get to Election Day. Well, that's not been happening this year with the Libertarian Party candidate and the Green Party candidate. Those percentages have been holding to just about what they were several months ago. And again, somewhat unexpectedly, those third-party candidates, minor party candidates, have been hurting Hillary Clinton somewhat more than they've been hurting Donald Trump. If you look at polls with simply a face-to-face of Clinton versus Trump, you find that Clinton's lead is more substantial than it is when you look at all four candidates in the field.
I was trying to look back in my own mind about the influence of third-party campaigns and candidacies, although looking back, not a great deal. You think of the candidacy of Ralph Nader in the Gore Bush campaign, took away probably enough votes from Gore in Florida to have changed that. The role of Ross Perot in the Clinton in two of Bill Clinton's elections arguably had an impact on it. So is it possible that the third parties are going to be a growing part of the American political experience?
I don't think that we can draw that conclusion from this particular election, because we didn't see this 4 years ago, and 4 years from now, it may be a very different scene. It's often said that Bill Clinton won because Ross Perot took a substantial number of votes away from his opponent. For the most part, analysts of the election returns say that's not so, that Perot drew evenly from both of the candidates.
This is kind of a complicated question. I might have to get you to help me ask it, but I'm wondering if whether or not there were a credible third party, a credible and well-financed third party like Mayor Bloomberg or like Ross Perot was when he ran as a third-party candidate, because a lot of the yearning of the country seems to be for just change and getting out from under regular politicians, whether or not that kind of candidacy would have worked, or has Trump taken all of that and hold all of that sort of, I'm voting for somebody who's different and who is a change. Has he brought that into the arena and there's no room for anyone else?
No, I think it's conceivable that we could have had a third-party candidate who would have had a considerably larger support than either of the minor party candidates now have gotten. But certainly, if the mantra is that we've got to return America to an earlier time when it was, quote, great, and that I'm the voice for change, I think you're right in supposing that Trump has taken most of the oxygen out of the room on those two claims.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with William Lichtenberg, preeminent historian of the presidency, and we're talking about this year's presidential election. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our friend and our counselor, William Lichtenberg, talking about the presidency. For those of you, few of you who don't remember Dr. Lichtenberg or haven't heard of him, he is the preeminent historian of the American presidency, and he's our Chapel Hill native. And I'd like to just say something about the book that's came out late last year.
Please do, DJ.
which prepares me and prepares many people to talk a little bit more intelligently about presidential elections and the character of the presidents that we've had. You've already said that it's hard to compare this election to prior ones, but can we talk about the candidates and whether or not there's some comparison, say, between Hillary Clinton and earlier candidates? It's hard to do, I know, because we have this woman not in a dress but in pantsuits, and we're not used to having a credible, important woman nominated by one of the major political parties.
It's one of the things that's striking about this campaign, I think, DG, is how a little attention that has been drawing. I would have thought early on that the prospect that we would have the first woman president in the United States would be an exciting development, particularly for American women, but not only for women. And I early on had the sense that didn't seem to be happening. And I think there's a little bit more as we get nearer to Election Day. The likelihood that that's going to happen is beginning to draw a certain sense of excitement that we hadn't been seeing up to now. And I would anticipate that when and if, and I think more likely when, she is elected, there will be a sense that America, for the first time, has a Maggie Thatcher, Golda Meir, Bhutto, the kind of leader that other countries have had, and we've been much too long in getting around to electing to lead our country.
I remember earlier in the primary campaign that when I first got hit upside the head with the fact that younger women were not rushing to support Hillary in the Sanders-Clinton campaign, and the women who were my age contemporaries got very huffy about the younger women who were saying, we're not automatically going to vote for a woman just because she's a woman. We're interested in ideals and leadership. And my contemporary women came back and said, this is just awful that you aren't doing this. But there has been kind of a generational change in the way women look at the election, and some of us kind of are left behind.
Yeah, in general, younger people are more likely to be supporting Hillary than older people are, but it doesn't break down on gender lines. You're right.
Well, what can you say about the candidacy of Donald Trump in terms of analogies in prior presidential campaigns? Have there been other times when presidential candidates have kind of come from way outside the establishment and preached the gospel of change and we could do things better and everybody who's in office now is incompetent and has done a terrible job?
Well, one of the things that's striking about Trump is not merely his message, but the fact that he has never held public office. If one asks, has there been a candidate for the presidency before who has run without any prior political office-holding experience, the answer is yes, as recently as the candidate you were mentioning a few minutes ago, Ross Perot. Curiously, the only office of any sort, political, that Perot had held as the Republican, a man who identified with the Republican Party, was that he had been an officer of Tammany Hall, the Democratic machine in New York City. But if one asks, was there a major party candidate who had never before held office, the answer is once again yes, but not since Wendell Willkie in 1940. Utility executive, the attorney, head of Commonwealth and Southern, a foe of the Tennessee Valley Authority, who had no office-holding experience in government. But that's a long, long ways back. We're talking about 76 years ago. And if you move on to your other point of was there a candidate who expressed so much dissatisfaction with the political process, there have been such figures, but there have been third-party figures. The man who most recently comes to mind is George Wallace. And like Donald Trump, targeting particular ethnic groups, in Wallace's case, African Americans in this country. But if you lump those two considerations together, if you ask, has there ever been anybody like Donald Trump before who was a major party candidate who was had no previous political office holding experience, and who targeted minorities and said that he was going to bring about change? No, I think in that respect, Donald Trump is a unique figure for whom there is no counterpart in the past.
Does Donald Trump's campaign reflect that lack of experience in terms Donald Trump as a candidate and his campaign reflect his lack of experience in terms of having public sector work?
I think it does.
In what
not
way?
Not with respect to policy so much, DG, as the a couple of other considerations. One is that he has been running such a poor campaign from the perspective of getting votes. He has been campaigning in states or in parts of states where his cause is hopeless, and has been ignoring areas where that are competitive. In the state of Maine, for example, and you know that we spend our, Jean Ann and I spend our summers in Maine.
In one of the congressional districts in Maine.
Yeah. Well, Maine is one of two states, the other Nebraska, where the electoral vote can be broken down, and you can win a part of the electoral vote of a state. And there is one district, the second congressional district, where which is quite conservative, where Trump has, it appeared, some chance of victory. Instead, he's been campaigning in heavily Democratic areas such as Portland. The latest polls show that the second congressional district voters are going to go for Hillary. The other area that shows a lack of political experience is the absence of what's called a ground game of getting out the vote. And we're at the point now where, with the presidential debates at an end, he no longer has an opportunity to make a large national impact. The single most important thing, not only for him, but for both candidates, for all four candidates, is to get their followers to the polls. And Trump has been doing a very poor job of that, as the early voting returns, so far as we know them, indicate. The more than 3 million people have already voted early, and the by about a very large percentage of those have been voting in people who have been voting are registered as Democrats. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're voting for Hillary, but it's highly likely that they are, because one of the striking aspects of this campaign has been that people who identify themselves as Democrat overwhelmingly say they're going to be voting for her in November, whereas Trump is getting only about 80% of people who identify as Republicans, which is to say one out of every five Republicans is not going to vote for him.
We're visiting with William Luxtenberg, eminent historian of the presidency. We're talking about the current presidential election. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bill Luxtenberg, our friend, Professor Emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and preeminent historian of the American presidency, many other accolades. At the end, if we get to it, we want to talk a little bit about your television experience. But right now, I'm worried about each of these presidential candidates for different reasons, about the challenges that they will face or that each of them might face should he or she be elected. And I wonder, just based on what other presidents have had to face, if you're worried about the kind of challenges that each of these will face and whether or not there's some that are going to be very difficult for them. You want to start with Hillary?
Well, I think they both, DG, face the problem that Barack Obama's had to deal with for these past 7 to 8 years of an obstreperous Congress. It's going to be hard for either of them to put through very large programs. How difficult it will be will depend in good part, of course, on the makeup of the Congress. There is some possibility that the Democrats may carry the United States Senate in November, overturn the Republican predominance there. If that does not happen, then Hillary would be faced with the difficult task of getting legislation through a Congress with both houses controlled by the opposition party. We've already seen an unfortunate aspect of this with Senator McCain saying that no matter who Hillary nominates for the United States Supreme Court, he's prepared to vote against the nominee sight unseen, which is the kind of attitude we've seen from Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate through all of the mm-hmm. Obama presidency.
You would know better than I, but we might be able to forgive him because he's running in a difficult reelection campaign in Arizona and dependent upon the obstreperous Republican vote that is very concerned about the Supreme Court. You think?
Well, I'll leave the forgiving to you on this. Actually, one of the striking things is it appeared that that he was in trouble and that this is one of the seats that the Democrats might win this year. But the most recent polls, he's 15 points ahead, and is
so we can't forgive him for remarks that were made to solidify that.
Yeah, right.
No, I don't want to argue with you about that. Other than that, I, still give McCain credit for the gracious way in which he dealt with President Obama during the campaign and afterwards.
I'd give McCain credit for lots of things.
Yeah, but not
of that sort. Yes.
Well, you've introduced this as a challenge that Hillary Clinton will have in terms of her options with respect to appointing a Supreme Court justice. It's been quieter than I would have expected, but it is a major reason that many people will be voting in the campaign either for or against Hillary Clinton. And what are the difficulties that she'll face with respect to the confirmation of her nominees? What are her options with respect to the nominee that President Obama has already made and is before the Senate now? And might she just say, I would like for the Senate to go ahead and confirm President Obama's nominee? What are her options, and what are the ups and downs of each one?
Well, there's been a statement just today from Bernie Sanders saying that he's planning to be a gadfly. And the left wing of the Democratic Party is unhappy with President Obama's nominee, wants a more liberal, a man with a more pronounced liberal record, so that if Hillary Clinton goes along with President Obama's nominee for the court, she's certainly going to be getting some flack probably from Bernie and from the left wing of the party. On the other hand, she can respond that President Obama named a man who was universally well regarded and thought to be a moderate, and I did him no good at all. So if we're going to have a fight on this, let's have a more progressive nominee who could affect jurisprudence for the next generation.
Well, let me argue with that point of view in thinking that if the Democrats have control of the Senate, she must persuade almost all of the Democrats to support her nominee, or she doesn't have a chance. But she's also got to pick up at least enough votes under current rules to avoid a filibuster. So she would be less likely to succeed at that if she appointed a very liberal or nominated a very liberal justice.
I think that's a perfectly reasonable point, DJ. There is a supposition you've just introduced to this, and that is that the Democrats will gain control of the Senate. And that's by no means clear. It's looking right now as though the Democrats will unseat the Republican senators in Wisconsin and in Illinois. They would still have to pick up three more seats in order to gain control of the Senate. One of the races that I've been looking at very closely has been that in New Hampshire, in part because they're the neighboring state when we're in Maine in the summer, and that race is well covered in the Portland and other Maine newspapers. But for a more immediate reason, a year or two ago, I was invited to lecture at Phillips Exeter in New Hampshire. And Jean Ann and I were invited to dinner with the headmaster and his wife. And his wife is the Democratic governor of New Hampshire, who's now running for the United States Senate, Maggie Hassan. And in the against the Republican incumbent, also a woman, Kelly Ayotte. My New Hampshire friends tell me that Maggie is not a very effective public speaker, which surprises me because in conversation she is scintillating, And the latest polls show her with an 8-point advantage in the election over Ayotte. Well, that would give the Democrats one of the other three that they would need, assuming they get Illinois and Wisconsin.
Are you thinking that they need 50, not a majority, but that they need 50 in case of the vice president, or do they need to get 51 to control things in the Senate? How does that work with the vice president?
Well, if there's an even 50-50 split, which has happened three times in the past, first in the late 19th century, then early in the Eisenhower presidency, most recently in 2000, one of the interesting questions that comes up is who organizes the Senate? And the answer is that the party who wins the White House, because, as you were indicating, it's the vice president who casts the deciding vote. But it's more complicated than that. After 2000, what happened is that the Democratic leader, Tom Daschle, insisted that if the Senate was going to function, he wanted a 50-50 split, since the Senate was 50-50, of the committee distribution and the financing for the committees. And he was able to negotiate that with Mitch McConnell. So it's expected that the new Democratic leader would be Chuck Schumer of New York. So Schumer and McConnell, who I don't think care very much for one another, would have to negotiate that for us to have a functioning Senate. So it's a muddled scene right now what either of the possibly winning candidates is going to confront in January.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with William Lechtenberg. We're talking about the presidential election, of course, and he and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Barton. I'm visiting with William Lechtenberg. We're talking about the presidential election, the current one. And I'm really disappointed with Professor Lechtenberg, because every other time we've talked about elections, he's been able to draw on his vast experience to give me multiple comparisons of the past with current political developments. You haven't been able to do that at all, have you, Dr. Lechtenberg?
I don't think any historian on earth could say that there was a counterpart for Donald Trump, or that we've had a campaign like this, D.G.
Can you look into the future a little bit, based either on the premise that Hillary Clinton will win, or on the premise that Trump will win, and see and look down the road into how things might work out in the next 4 years politically? For instance, let's just say, first of all, if Hillary Clinton wins, what are the kinds of things that history tells us will happen 2 years from now in the elections, and then 4 years from now when she runs for re-election as sort of for a fourth term of the Democratic? Does history have any lessons to teach us about what challenges Hillary Clinton will face politically down the road?
Well, one of the reasons that the Democrats have a fair chance of winning control of the United States Senate this time is that so many of the incumbents are Republicans. 2 years from now, the reverse is true. So that even if Hillary Clinton has the good fortune of starting off with a Democratic Senate, she could well lose it 2 years down
the road. As Barack Obama did. There is a wave of resistance to the president after the first 2 years, and in that election, usually there are challenges.
Well, that is certainly true, but what I'm suggesting, it's also the happenstance of of what class is up and in any particular midterm election.
If she's elected president and then is up for and decides to run for re-election, what are the challenges that will face her based on the historical experience as you look back for the past 200
right, years? Right. Well, I would suppose that the two things that leap out at you are the difficulty America has been having in the Middle East, and particularly with ISIS, and the high likelihood that difficulties, if not the same, precisely the same, will be around 2 years later, and it will be said that she has not resolved a predicament which arguably nobody has any high hopes of resolving. The other is that there could be dissatisfaction with the economy. The circumstance under President Obama is that we're very much better off now than we were when he took office after the downturn in the presidency of the second George Bush. And nonetheless, there's a widespread belief that we're not doing well. And Trump has been able to exploit that sense of we've got to change America. So I think, in short, no matter how well the economy is doing, when she certainly 2 years later with the next midterm election, or 4 years later when she runs for a second term, she's likely to find an undercurrent of unhappiness. I don't mean an undercurrent that is purely irrational, because in this new global economy, some Americans are going to be left behind. And that's true in states such as Ohio today. And there's a real reason for dissatisfaction on the part of voters, a dissatisfaction that no president, Obama or anybody else or any of his successors, is very likely to be able to alleviate.
Well, talk just for a minute about what Republicans might do to take advantage of these factors that you mentioned in terms of preparing for the 2020 election, presidential election. Do you think it will begin, assuming the Republicans lose the presidential election, will the contest for the Republican nomination begin immediately?
I think so. The candidate who's being widely talked about is Pence, in part because people don't know much about him. He is considerably more of a right-wing ideologue than has emerged in this campaign. And when he's scrutinized more closely, I don't think he's going to come across as someone who is above party or above ideology, which is the circumstance now. Also, there's not going to be the contrast easily drawn between his demeanor and that of his senior running mate. But I would think that that a lot of the talk will be about Pence at the outset.
Well, I can't wait for the election to be over for lots of reasons. And then one of them is that after it's over, you and I can get together again and you can talk with even more informed wisdom than you brought wonderfully to us today. Thank you, Bill Lechtenberg.
Thank you, D.G.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.